Right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you all here. And I've been asked to announce that today's Shia is being sponsored by Ziva and David Katz. In loving memory of David's father, Yechezkel ben David Yehuda Zichron Nivracha, whose Yahrzeit is on the 10th of Shabbat. You'll also notice that the printed text I've dedicated on page 2, dedicated to the memory of a wonderful couple, Sora Pesa Leah Bas Yitzhak, Ochai Nitzak Elia Ben Zev, Henry and Wendy Breacher, of blessed memory, of London. We are, in this course of Shiurim, we're looking at historical figures that contributed greatly to the development of Jewish life and from whose legacy we are still deriving benefit to this day. And I started last week looking at the life and times of the Abarbanel, and you can see on your sheet in front of you the dates of the Abarbanel, 1437 to 1508. And I just want to remind you that, of course, in those dates, the most significant and cataclysmic event was the expulsion from Spain in 1492. And this was, in a sense, the key event in the life of Yitzhak Abarbanel. As I will explain, we touched on it last week already, but Yitzhak Abarbanel grew up in an aristocratic, influential and wealthy family in Portugal. He was educated in Lisbon, and his family were involved in politics, in banking, in wealth, in and very deeply in the Jewish life. But at the same time, he was given a very good both Jewish and secular education. He was clearly proficient not only in Spanish and Portuguese, but also in Latin, in Greek, and certainly in Hebrew, and possibly in other languages as well. And he was one of the most remarkable scholars of his age. And he wrote a classic commentary to almost the entire Tanakh, almost the entire of Chumash and the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim. You will find commentary of the Abarbanel. And I'd like to speak a little bit today about his commentary and what his contribution was to Jewish life, Jewish thinking, and Jewish understanding. And maybe first, let's say what he wasn't involved in. He wasn't involved in writing anything on the Talmud or on the Halakha. So in that sense, he was a completely different figure, say, to either Rashi or Maimonides or the Rambam. Rashi and Maimonides were involved in commentaries. Rashi wrote his commentary on the Tanakh, and Rambam writes his codification of Jewish law in the Mori Nevuch, in the Mishnah Torah. And in a sense, both of these commentaries were, of course, available to the Abarbanel, and he draws on them. But he himself accepts completely the Rambam as the halachic authority in the Jewish world, in this, like all of the Sfarad Jewry accepted the Rambam as the last word in halachic authority, and he doesn't challenge him on that. He does, however, write another commentary also on the Rambam's Mori Nevuchim, and the Rambam engages in philosophy. The Abarbanel writes a commentary on the Rambam in which he allows himself to be somewhat critical of the Rambam's ideas. He's got one very beautiful line in which occurs a couple of times in his commentary on the Mori Nevuchim, where he says he constantly refers to the Rambam as a Rabbeinu Moshe. The Rambam's name was Moshe ben Maimon, Rabbeinu Moshe. So he gives him great deference as the great, as the Godel Hador, really. The Rambam had been writing 300 years earlier, but his writings were the formative writings halachically of the whole Jewish world, certainly in Spain and Portugal and the Spanish areas. But in his commentary on the Mori Nevuchim, occasionally he writes that this is indeed the view of Rabbeinu Moshe, but I doubt that these were the ideas of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what he writes in a couple of places. He says, these ideas are not the ideas of Moshe Rabbeinu, they are the ideas of Rabbeinu Moshe. So that's his sort of way of saying that he's not sure that some of the Rambam's ideas are indeed correct from his point of view. I mention this because one of the most interesting features of the Abarbanel, and maybe this is one of his greatest, most enduring contributions to Torah learning, is his originality and his fearlessness in being original. Prior to the Abarbanel, most commentaries had stuck to traditional lines. Rashi is not an original commentator by and large. Rashi gives you his collection of midrashic material. He singles out various different points in the Midrash as opposed to others, but Rashi's commentary is the classic, Likut, sort of a collection of midrashic ideas on the Chumash and on the whole Tanakh. And similarly, the Ramban and our commentaries before them had really dealt with what is the meaning of the words, what is Hebrew grammar, how do we understand this pasuk and that pasuk and the other pasuk. The Abarbanel, in a sense, was the beginning of what might be called a modern commentary. Modern commentary in the sense that he's asking questions that people haven't asked before, and he's looking at broader themes. Right? So whereas there might be an interesting piece in the Chumash about how Moshe Rabbeinu deals, say, with Korach, the Abarbanel is interested, what exactly is the nature of nevuah, of prophecy itself? How does prophecy work? Why does prophecy happen to some people and not to others? And he engages in broader issues. In today's parasha, for example, in B'Shalach, so we find that the Jewish people coming out after Kriyas Yamsuf, they're coming out into the desert, and there's a whole drama about the fact that they come to a place where there's no water to drink, and the water that is there is not drinkable. It's Mayim Morim, it's bitter waters, and that's why the place was called Morah. And then there's the whole issue of what happens there at Morah and how the waters were made sweet, one thing another. The Abarbanel has a commentary on this whole parsha, which he prefaces by asking 25 questions on the parsha. 25 questions just on this piece of B'Shalach. Some of them are philosophical, some of them are psychological, some of them are just general questions. Why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu take the Jewish people in the first place into a part of the desert where there's no water to drink? Obviously, a few million people together with women and children coming out into the desert obviously need water to drink. Why was this situation created in the first place? How do we understand that? These are the sort of questions you won't find in Rashi or in the Ramban or in anywhere else. You will find them. Why do I call it a modern commentary? Because you will find these questions, for example, in a 19th century commentaries, like the Malbim will ask these questions. Samson Raphael Hirsch will ask these questions, right? The Netziv will ask these sort of questions, which are sort of thematic questions. You know, when Avram Avinu engages in certain activities with Paro and Avimelech and Sarah, so he's asking moral questions. Why does Avram do this? Is this morally acceptable to behave in such a way? Which Rashi will never ask a question like that. So if, in other words, he is already allowing himself, on the one hand, he's completely firmly rooted in the belief system of Chazal, in the Yud Gimel Ikrim, in the Emunah. He's not challenging any items of faith or belief of Klal Yisrael. But with that, he looks at the text of the Tanakh and he looks for the big picture issues. How do we understand this morally speaking? How do we understand this sort of behavior? Why was this situation created in the first place? And that makes his commentary very thought-provoking in a certain way. What makes his commentary less popular, and you'll find many people learn Chumash and rarely go to the Abarbanel, is that it's very long. It's very long-winded. Can you imagine, you want to bring a commentary on one piece of B'Shalach, And he's got 25 questions first. And each one of those questions is complicated. And then he comes to answer, to explain the parasha. So what we really need to do, if anybody's looking for a new lifetime project, is a Kitzur Abarbanel. You need somebody who is able to give us a synopsis of the commentary of the Abarbanel. The best of my knowledge, this has not been done. Even a good English translation of the Abarbanel. Now, there is some English translations out in the last 10 years, but a good English translation of the Abarbanel is still something which needs to be done. But he was certainly a man of great scholarship, great fit. It's possible, I think, possibly his fearlessness also was connected to the fact that he was so immensely wealthy and influential in his lifetime, certainly in the first part of his lifetime. And people who are wealthy and influential tend to feel that they can say their opinion without fear of contradiction. He had that sort of mindset, right? I remember in London for a while, for about 10 years, I was giving lunchtime shiurim in the city. And in these lunchtime shiurim, in boardrooms in the city, there were quite a few like multimillionaire Jews, CEOs of big companies, and when they asked a question in the shiur, they didn't ask it the same way as the honorable members of my shiur here ask a question. They asked a question with a tone of voice and with a power of personality, as if to say, sort of, this is my view, and I dare anybody to challenge this or contradict it. It comes with the territory in a certain sense. People in a certain financial or political position, they express themselves differently, right? And you do feel that a little bit in Yitzhak Abarbanel's writings, that he was a man of immense wealth and influence and scholarship. And he says, this is the way it is. And why would, and even when he, so to speak, in his commentary, addressing himself to people like to Avraham Avinu or Moshe Rabbeinu, he will not hesitate to say, why would they do something like this, right? It's inexcusable. And then he'll try to explain why they did it and what the Torah means. Were they right? Were they wrong? So he's actually got novel interpretations, for example, about the misdeeds of, say, that's what I want to learn with you inside a little bit. I brought you a little bit of Hebrew text. The misdeeds of Moshe and Aaron. Yes. Is he still going to this is a good question. The question asked was he still wealthy after he was expelled from Spain? And the answer is no. But even before that, he grew up in Portugal and he had immense wealth, part of it inherited, part of it made by himself. And he was basically the financial director of the Minister of Finance of Portugal for many years. And in that position, he amassed an enormous amount of wealth. When Alfonso died and the next king took over, so then he knew that his life was on the line and he fled penniless. He fled to Spain penniless, right? So he lost his initial fortune. He then subsequently in Spain made another fortune, which he again lost when he was expelled from Spain. So his life, from a financial point of view, had its ups and downs. But when he was up, he was massively up. And when he was down, he was incredibly down. So this is not a regular life, the life of the Abarbanel. It's a life, he was typical in a sense of that era, which was a very, very difficult era, an era of crisis. I'll tell you something interesting I touched on last week, but I looked at it again last few days. In his writings, when he is arrived in Spain, right, and he's lost his entire wealth and his power and his status and everything, and he's just arrived in Spain as a refugee from Portugal, right, he sits down and starts writing commentaries on the Torah, starts engaging in Torah and he writes prolifically, I mean, phenomenal quantities and phenomenal quality. And in one or two places he writes that he knows why God punished him and made him lose his fortune was because he wasn't dedicating enough time to Torah and spiritual pursuits. He was too involved in statesmanship and in, you know, marbe nechosim, marbe dago, the Mishnah says, that people who have enormous wealth, they're preoccupied with their wealth and they haven't got time to become talmidei chachamim. So he's in a sense regretting, in a certain sense, his first life in Portugal, which was really a life of finance, politics, and intrigue, in a certain sense. Politics wasn't just being a politician, but the all the different ins and outs of politics which he was involved in. He was an advisor to the king, advisor to the court. He was involved in lots of different wars that Portugal fought against other nations, and he raised loans for the king to finance wars. That's how wars took place in the ancient, in the Middle Ages. The kings, in order to fight battles, had to finance the battle. To finance the battle, they had to either raise more taxes, or they had to take out loans, or they had to simply steal people's wealth. There were all sorts of ways they could do it, and they needed their finance ministers to organize this. And so the Abarah Bonel was a maestro in this field, and but he realized that this, in a sense, he was wasting his life, because he should dedicate, because of his tremendous scholarship and his mind and his love of Torah, he should be dedicating his life to Torah. So whenever he went into what we might call a misfortune, he in a sense saw it as a, God was freeing him. He was freeing him from this heavy load of having to manage his fortune and having to manage the court and all the political issues, and now he's free to join a kollel, you know what I mean, to sit and learn, and that was for him as great. And then what happens is, within a year that he arrives in Spain, the king enlists him to work as his finance minister in Spain, and he does that for another 10 years until he's expelled from Spain. Again, he's penniless, and again he starts writing, and again he expresses the same sentiment. That here I am, returning to my writings, after having lost all my status and wealth, but Baruch Hashem, I can now do what I really love doing, which is learning and teaching Torah and writing my commentary on the. So it's paradoxical in a certain sense, but he had a perspective of emunah, which was, he regarded himself not only as a commentator, as a scholar, but as also a national leader. In other words, he was aware that all these expulsions and the Inquisition had a very depressing effect on the Jews of Spain. The Jews of Spain lived in fear. Right? They were living, and many of them had lost everything they'd ever built up. And he dedicates a lot of his writings to encouraging them and explaining to them not to lose their belief and not to lose their commitment, and that this in some way is all min hashamayim. Maybe next week I'll dedicate a shiur to his whole concept of Mashiach, because he was very much into a messianistic understanding of his period. He felt that his period was certainly sort of the preamble to Mashiach. But that's a separate story. Yes, you want to make a point? Well, that's a very interesting point. I'd like to take up that point. Very interesting. He makes this point, particularly in his commentary on Yeshua, Shoftim, Melochim Aleph, and Melochim Beis, because he says, I am particularly qualified, he says, to write a commentary about the kings of Israel, because there are not many commentators before me who have lived with kings, who have seen how kings think and what their challenges are, and how to overcome the difficulties of becoming a ruler of a country, and therefore I'm very qualified to do it. As a result of which, oh, this is a very interesting point, actually. Let me just spend a few minutes dealing with a classic theme in the Tanakh, which is dealt with by lots of commentaries, which a classic question mark in in Shmuel Aleph, in the book of Shmuel, the first book of Shmuel, chapter 8, what happens there is the Jewish people at that period, they come to the prophets, to Shmuel, and they say, Ten lonu melech, we want a king. We've never had a king, right? We've been in Israel already probably about 300 years or so from the time Yeshua came into the land of Israel. Throughout the whole book of Joshua and the book of Judges, there's been no king. There's only been judges, right? There's been Deborah and Gideon and Shimshon. They've had leaders, but they haven't had any kings. And at a certain point, and Eli was the Kohen Gadol, was the last of the Shoftim, and he was the Kohen Gadol, and his sons were not fitting to follow him. So the people said to Shmuel, give us a king. Shmuel gets very, very angry. Why do you want a king? A king is not a blessing. He gives them a whole fiery Musa drasha. But then in the end, he concedes and he appoints King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech, within a couple of years, turns out to be a mistake. And then Shmuel still appoints David HaMelech. And that turns out to be the right way forward. This is a very complicated saga in the Tanakh, on which there is an enormous amount of Medrash, Talmud, and commentaries. And but one of the interesting questions, I'm just going to pick up one part of this whole question, is the following question. The Torah says, in the book of Devarim, there's a pasuk which says, Som to simolecho melech, kasha yivcha Hashem lekecha. One of the Tariag mitzvahs is to appoint a king. Right? If it's true that it's a mitzvah to appoint a king, why is Shmuel so angry with the people when they say, let's have a king? This is a massive question on which, as I say, the Ramban talks about it, and Rashi and the Midrashim and the Drashas Haran. There are lots and lots of different speculative answers to this question, why that is. And the Abar Banel actually gets into this subject from a point of view that I mentioned just before. He says, I can testify, right, that having a king with absolute power is a disaster. Giving anybody absolute power is a total disaster, because once a human being gets absolute power, he goes mad. He becomes a power-hungry individual and eventually ends up destroying everything, right? And therefore, why would you want a king? A king implies this immense concentration of power in the hands of one person. And so then the question is, so what is the Torah talking about when it says you should appoint a king? Why does the Torah say it? So he gets into a very interesting analysis, pages and pages of analysis, which is all very much commentary on his time. He says, look, I can tell you kings are people who are really mostly in egomaniacs and in total destructive mode and are very dangerous people. But there are, he says, other models. And he gets into what we would call today political philosophy. He says there are models apart from monarchies. There are republics, right, which don't have a king, right? And he was particularly fond of Venice. Now, Venice today we know as a very pretty city in Italy, but in the ancient world, Middle Ages, Venice was an independent republic which had no king and was independent of all the other kingdoms around. And he, the Barbanel, was very loved Venice and thought that it was the model going forward, to go forward without a king, and as a republic, and to have governors which had to rotate and give each other, only stay for 2 or 3 years and hand over to other governors. And he gets into a whole system of how politics could work without a king. A bit similar, incidentally, to the founding fathers of the United States of America, who based America on the idea that the King of England was a lunatic, in which they were certainly correct, and that listening to him was a bad move. And what we need to is establish a political system where the president can only serve for a finite amount of years, and he is subject to checks and balances of the legal system and everything, how to control the power of a leader. That was, so the Americans devised their own answer to the question. But the question, says the Abarbanel, already exists in the Tanakh. Right, that the Torah indeed gives us a mitzvah to have a king, that the king is not a king with absolute power. If you read the Pesukim, he says in Sefer Devarim, this king, right, the king that the Torah wants us to have is a king who is, first of all, he's subject to the advice of the Navi, the prophet. The job of the prophet is to tell the truth to the king. No one else is allowed to tell the truth to the king. And anyone tells truth to the king, it's off with his head, right? You're not allowed to criticize the king, but the Navi is allowed to criticize the king. He's also subject to the halacha. The king is subject to the halachic system, right? And he has to have a Sefer Torah with him. The Pasuk says in Devarim, the king has to have his own Sefer Torah. And he has to learn the Torah, and he has to realize that he is subject to the Torah in the same way as every member of the Jewish people is subject to the Torah. In other words, all these limitations that the king has, what the Torah has in mind. And even so, at the end, the Abarbano makes it a radical suggestion. He says, really, when the Torah says the people will ask for a king, give them a king, it's a mitzvah to have a king, this is not a chiyuv, he says. The Torah isn't saying it's the right thing to do. It's saying, if people want a king, give them a king of this type, with these checks and balances. But actually, it's better not to have one at all. And he says, in the halacha, we do find halachas which are not obligatory, right? But it's just, I'll give you an example, right? Let's say there is no mitzvah in the Torah to eat meat. There's no mitzvah to eat meat, except for korbanos. Yes, you're quite right. Except for in the context of the Beis HaMikdash and korbanos. But outside of that, there's no obligation to eat meat. But the Torah says, if you want to eat meat, only these animals and not those animals, only shechted this way, not that way, only if they're not treifa. In other words, there are 20 different conditions that the Torah sets if you want to eat meat. But if you don't want to eat meat, the Torah doesn't force you to do so, right? So in the same way, all the halachas of shechita and treifas and meat and milk, all that, right, are in a sense optional mitzvahs. They're not obligatory mitzvahs. If you want to eat meat, keep it separate from milk. If you want to eat meat, only eat cows and not horses, right? There are all sorts of limitations the Torah gives us, but it's all what might call contingent halachas. They're all halachas which are not obligatory, like putting on tzitzis or tefillin or keeping Shabbos or whatever. So the chiddush of the Abarbanel is that the mitzvah to appoint a king is like that. The mitzvah to appoint a king is, if you want a king, right, you shouldn't have one really, it's better not to. And that's what he says, Yoshua and Devorah and Gideon and Shimshon, they all understood it's better not to have a king. In fact, I don't know if you're aware, but in Sefer Shoftim, after Gideon has proved himself to be both a spiritual and military leader of the highest order, the Ziknei Yisrael come to Gideon and say, be our king, establish a monarchy. And Gideon says, thank you very much, but that's not for me. He's the only one, actually, of all the Shoftim who is actually invited by Ziknei Yisrael to establish a monarchy. But he steps back and he says, no, I don't. So the Baal Bana says, you know why? Because he understood that the power concentrated in the monarchy in the ancient world. I mean, today we've got a monarchy, like I'm British, right? So in England, we've got a queen, right? But the queen has got no real power, right? The queen is a dignitary figure, is a figure of status and a figure of the Queen's main job is for American tourists. You understand that, don't you? The Queen's main job is to create a certain amount of excitement and color and parades and guards in silly uniforms. All these things, that's all very nice. That's all the paraphernalia. Yeah, all crazy things. She's got no real power. But in the ancient world, of course, kings had total power. They didn't have to consult. They weren't answerable to anybody. They didn't have to consult anybody. They could execute whoever they wanted to, right? King Henry VIII decided to massacre all the priests and nuns and monks in the whole of the UK. Simply because he's decided he doesn't like Catholicism anymore. He wants to change the country into a Protestant country because he wanted to marry another woman and the Catholics wouldn't let him. So basically he executed thousands and tens of thousands of all the Catholic priests and nuns and monks in the UK. And nobody could say anything to him. That was it. He was able to do whatever he wanted to do. So says the Abravanel, appointing a king, I have told you first. But what's beautiful about his commentary is that it's a first-hand account of Ferdinand and Isabella, right? And ironically, he himself was a casualty of the not of the Inquisition, fortunately, but he was a casualty of the expulsion from Spain, together with another 300,000-400,000 Jews who were sent into poverty and an exile after centuries of being a really honest and loyal Spanish subjects and practicing Judaism in the most profitable way for everybody. They were all expelled. So he saw firsthand that the kings were unmanageable and were not a blessing. And he brings that into his commentary. It's very, very interesting how he brings it in. And that's a part of his original. He's got lots of original bits and pieces also along the way. So, for example, in the parasha a couple of weeks ago, when there's the second plague, right? So you have Dom Tzfardea. Tzfardea is the second of the 10 plagues. So we normally think that Tzfardea are what? Frogs. So he brings a whole list of different sources and from different languages of one thing and another. He says, they are not frogs. Frogs are just annoying. That's not a plague. It's not a plague to have frogs hopping around, croaking. That's not a plague. These were crocodiles. He says, the crocodiles, the Nile is full of crocodiles. When it turned into blood, all the crocodiles who are amphibians, they came out of the water and they invaded the country, and they were crocodiles. That was the plague. And he's got this whole thing about crocodiles, which I've never seen. Actually, I've never seen in any other commentator that the way he describes it, it's just original. Do you understand? There's nothing wrong with that commentary. He opens the door to originality in understanding the Torah. And that's why we can have, for example, people like the Malbim and Samson Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century giving us ideas on the Chumash, which no one has ever said before. And you think, well, wait a minute, what right have they got to innovate new ideas, right? Which is not found in any of the original sources. And the answer is Talmud Torah is like that. Talmud Torah allows for originality, provided that it's within the framework of the Yesodei Hadat. In other words, there are principles of belief, right? The Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Ani Mamin of the Rambam. If you're within those Yud Gimel Ikrim, you can interpret the narrative, not the halachic part of the Chumash, but the narrative of the Chumash is open to interpretation. And you and I, if we are sufficiently scholarly, can also come up with Chidushei Torah, with novel interpretations. But he, the Abarbanel, among the classic Mefarshim, he was the one that really opened the door to do that. If it was, yes, David. What was the source of his wealth? Well, first of all, he came from generations of extremely wealthy landowners in Portugal. So a lot of it he inherited. But in addition to it, he was what we would call today a financial whiz. I think that's the right word, isn't that right? A financial wizard, right? He knew how to borrow and lend and invest and buy and sell and do all sorts of things in a way that the non-Jewish world around him, and even the Jewish world around him, were absolutely sort of gobsmacked by his ability in this field. So much so that when he arrives in Spain, within a year, he's headhunted, send me word for it, he's headhunted by King Ferdinand, and says, you are going to run the finances of my country. Now, I just want to mention to you, I think I touched on it last week, that he didn't run it alone. He had another Jewish boy with him, right? That was a man called Avraham Sinior. I think I mentioned his name last week. Avraham Sinior was his colleague in the Ministry of Finance. And between the two of them, they really, first of all, they ran the, they were both Talmidei Chachamim. They were both people of great knowledge. They were highly respected within the Spanish community, because they ran the Jewish community, and they also ran the finances of Spain at the time. And they were also advisors to the king and the queen. And that's why it was so unthinkable. It's one of the extraordinary things about expulsion from Spain, incidentally. No one saw it coming. That's an extraordinary thing. Nobody saw it. It's one of the strange things about world history, that some of the biggest... Yes, because Itamar's right. Nobody wanted to see it coming. Even people who were standing there and it was happening in front of them day by day, they didn't want to see it coming. And because they didn't want to see it coming, they couldn't see it. They couldn't see it happening until it was too late. Right? There was no way to avert it because it came upon them like a ton of bricks. And you would have thought, in retrospect, you would have thought, well, who couldn't have predicted that? That was clearly the next stage along the way. But that's all only in hindsight. Right? Hindsight is a wonderful thing, right? In hindsight, you can see lots of things. In our lifetime, ladies and gentlemen, nobody predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. Nobody knew that. The Pentagon employed hundreds of Kremlin watchers and experts in Russia and Russian history and Russian politics and Russian military, and they analyzed every person. They knew every individual in the Kremlin and everything. And then when it happened, right, when the whole of the Soviet Empire crumbled, it crumbled like a popped balloon. Not a single person predicted that the Soviet Union was going to collapse. It was a world power. It was a nuclear power. It was on par with America. All the Americans thought of the Soviet Union as their nemesis, right? Their greatest enemy in the world. And suddenly, from one day to the next, v'einenu, right? It ceased to exist. Nobody predicted this. It's an extraordinary thing in world affairs. These things sometimes happen. And after they've happened, in retrospect, you would have thought, well, obviously it was going to happen. How could it not have happened? And that's what happened with the expulsion from Spain. Expulsion from Spain was something which really came out of nowhere. They couldn't protect themselves from it, and it was disastrous. Incidentally, I just want to mention to you, people think that the expulsion from Spain was a natural consequence of the Inquisition. Now, this is not true. The Inquisition started already 100 years earlier. The Inquisition, just want to make this point, even though it's a bit of a complicated point, the Inquisition really wasn't aimed at Jews. It was aimed at Marranos, at conversos, at the new Christians who had... The Inquisition was aimed at people who were living as Christians, but were secretly practicing Judaism. And the church was furious with them for having deceived them, and they were just determined to uproot them and destroy them and burning at the stake, and the persecution of the Inquisition was cruelty, inhuman at its worst. But it wasn't aimed against the Jews. It was aimed against the conversos. And therefore the Jews, the people who had kept their Judaism all the time, that had avoided forced conversions in one way or another, they felt safe. They weren't only safe, they were some of the wealthiest and most influential people in the whole country, right? And then this happened. I mean, the Jews of Germany, equally, many of them, sadly, didn't see it coming. I know in my own family, my mother's a Chron Lebracha, came from Germany, and she was the only one of her family who got out in time. And she was sitting and talking to her parents and her siblings and her cousins and uncles and everybody and saying, look, we've seen Kristallnacht, we've got to get out. She was only 18 years old. We've got to get out because this is going to take over the whole country. And they all said to her, what are you talking about? The German people are a people of culture, of civilization. They've always welcomed the Jews. We've always worked well. We are proud German Jews, right? What are you talking about? These Nazis, they're thugs, they're criminals. They won't last long. They'll never get into power. The Deutsche Volk will never allow the Nazis to get into power. And they sat there and they just waited for the Holocaust to happen. And by the time they woke up to it, it was too late. They couldn't get out anymore. So my mother, Zecharia Nevracha, was the sole survivor of a big family in Germany, all of whom knew about Kristallnacht, knew about the Nazi party, but they didn't see it coming. In retrospect, the mind boggles at that. We can't imagine such a thing. But as Itamar said before, they didn't want to see it. Right? My grandfather in Germany still served with distinction in the First World War, fighting for Germany, as did many Jews. Many Jews in Germany fought for Germany in the First World War. They had medals. Says, what, they're going to throw me out? Me? I'm a war hero. How could they throw me out? Right? All of this came to naught when the Nazis got into power. And a similar thing happened with the expulsion from Spain, that people who felt that they were like these two people. If you would have asked Yitzhak Abarbanel and Abraham Senior in 1491, do you think you will ever be expelled from Spain penniless with the Jewish expulsion? They would have laughed. They would have said, well, that's not, it's just not possible. With our contacts and our wealth and our power and our status, it's not possible that this could happen to us. And yet, it did. Yes, David. They were both invited to stay. Both Senior and Abarbanel were invited to stay on condition that they converted. If they were willing to convert, they could stay. If they were willing to convert, they would stay. They could stay. But Abarbanel decided not to convert. As I mentioned to you last week, Senior decided that he would convert. So he did convert and he did stay. But as I mentioned, I think last week, that was mainly because he was very, very elderly at the time and he knew he wouldn't survive any trip of that nature. And he also felt he could help the Jews on their way out, so to speak. He thought he'd be able to oil the wheels, and maybe he was. We don't have records of that, but maybe he was. But he was also an important person in this whole story. I'd like to now learn with you inside. So in the sheet in front of you, on the second side of your sheet, there is some Hebrew text. Let me give you a 2-minute introduction to this Hebrew text. This Hebrew text is dealing with a tricky problem in the Chumash. One of the great tragedies of the Chumash is that the Jewish people coming out of Egypt, as we're reading in these parshas, the Jewish people are coming out of Egypt, and where are they going to? The land of Israel, right? That is the plan, right? That's at least plan A. Plan A is everybody goes, right? The Pasuk says in the beginning of Vayera, Vatsesi, Vitalti, Vigoalti, Vilokachti, I'll take you out of Egypt, Vehevesi Eschem El Aretz, and I'll bring you all to the land which I swore to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that you will get to. In other words, the plan was Yetzias Mitzrayim straight into the land of Israel. That was the original plan. What happens? There's a tragedy of the story of the spies, and because of that, as a punishment for the spies, the Torah says, this generation will not make it to the land of Israel, the next generation will, and that's what happens. So only 40 years later, the next generation come into the land of Israel. The question, though, is what about Moshe and Aaron themselves? Let's focus on Moshe for a minute. Moshe himself, right? So what's the story with Moshe Rabbeinu? Surely he should be allowed to come into the land of Israel, right? And one of the great tragedies is that Moshe Rabbeinu does not make it into the land of Israel. Kadosh Baruch Hu takes him in the end of the book of Devarim. Kadosh Baruch Hu takes him up to the top of the mountain, and he says, look at this lovely land. Yes, you will see it, Roshama Loi Tova, but you won't get there. You can see the destination, but you won't get there. Moshe Rabbeinu never made it into the land of Israel. And this is one of the big tragedies in the Chumash. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu davens and begs HaKadosh Baruch Hu repeatedly, right? Parshas Voeschanan, right? The second parsha of Book of Devarim, Voeschanan El Hashem Voesahi Leimar, right? Moshe Rabbeinu davened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chazal say he davened more than 500 times to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, begging to be allowed into the land of Israel. And the answer was no. Right? So this is a very interesting event. And what was it that Moshe Rabbeinu had done? You would have thought after all that he had done for the Jewish people, right? Yetzias Mitzrayim and the splitting of the Red Sea and Har Sinai and all the 40 years in the desert and looking after them and guiding them and teaching them, he deserved to see the goal, the end state. And yet he was denied that. Why was he denied? What had he done so wrong? So you probably know, right? The story, the Chumash itself deals with this question. And the Chumash says, well, in one particular event, in the 40th year when they didn't have any water and God told him to go and speak to the rock, what does he do? He hits the rock instead of speaking to the rock, and the apostle says, oh, because you did this, you can't go into the land of Israel. What was Moshe Rabbeinu's Aveira? Now, this is something which exercises the minds of all the Mefarshim, bar none. Everybody tries to get, does it really make sense that because of this Aveira, he isn't allowed into the land of Israel? It doesn't really make sense. And therefore, one needs a deeper interpretation of what's going on. That is my introduction to this little piece of Avraham Avinu. So let's learn a little bit inside, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? And those of you on Zoom, you'll just have to listen and follow along. V'da'ati b'zeh. Can you see the Hebrew text you have on page 2? V'da'ati b'zeh. Yes. And my view is, Shemoshe v'Aaron, Shenehem ne'enshu ba'avor avonos she'osu. They were both punished for different averus completely, averus that they had done, which are not mentioned explicitly in the Torah. So he says, Im Aharon ba'avon ha'egel, Aharon HaKohen took part in the golden calf incident. If you remember the story, by Moshe Rabbeinu is at the top of Har Sinai, the people are clamoring for leadership, and Aharon agrees to help them manufacture this golden calf. Why was he doing it? It was a delaying mechanism. He said, you know what? To keep them sort of busy and happy until Moshe eventually appears, I'll just do this. But it went wrong. His intentions were good, but he says, V'im Moshe Adonenu, and about what he'll come back to it in a minute, and with Moshe Rabbeinu, our master, Inyan HaMeraglim. Moshe Rabbeinu did an Aveira, which is not explicit in the Torah, regarding the Meraglim. What is this about? So look, this is the Avraham Avinu at his best. He's coming in and giving an interpretation to this event that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody before him had ever suggested. He says, Lo shahoya Aaron mi'ovdei ha'egel. Chas v'shalom, he says, Aaron, of course, did not worship the golden calf. V'lo shahoya Moshe midor ha'meraglim. Neither was Moshe taken in by the false reporting of the spies. Cholilo lahem meresha, God forbid that they should be involved in those bad misdeeds. But he says, I'm in the third line, I will Aaron, Moshe's boy, Bimkomo, Aaron, as I explain in my commentary, right, in the parsha of the Egel Azar, which is in Kisisa, Shelo b'kavona ra, say Egel, he didn't do it with bad intentions. He just wanted to delay the people, and to make them sort of calm down until Moshe would appear, and then they'd once again connect to Moshe. But the consequences of his actions were what they were. In other words, what he says is that we know the disastrous consequences of the golden calf, that they made a mistake with the golden calf and started worshipping it. And as a consequence of which, they were denied coming to the land of Israel. And Aaron was a contributing factor in this story. And that's part of God's judgment. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu caused that generation to die in the desert and not come to the land of Israel, he also would share their fate. He would share the fate of that generation. Why? Because he contributed to one of their main misdeeds. So that's Aaron. But on the Chet Moshe, what did Moshe do wrong? When the Jewish people asked to send spies out to check out the land, all they asked for were directions. What's the best route for the army to come into the land of Israel to have success? And when God agrees to sending the Meraglim, all he said was, let the spies go and check out the land. So that, like all armies, need a certain advanced knowledge, right? In the absence of GPS systems and aerial photography, you want to know what awaits you. Are they mountains? Are they valleys? Which are the roads? What are the routes? Moshe Adonenu Hosef Me'atzmo B'Shlichus. And we find that Moshe Rabbeinu adds a lot to the job description of the spies, Mash Yisrael Oshalo Alem, which wasn't asked for. V'akadosh Baruch Hu Lotzi B'Behem, what did Moshe Rabbeinu say? Sheyiru Es Ha'om Hayoshev Ba'aretz Hechazok, I want you to bring back a report, he asks the Meraglim. Bring us back a report about the land. Is it a good land? Are the people there strong? How are they camped? All these details were not in the original brief. The original brief, both from the people and from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was sent to Meraglim just to help out as pathfinders for the army. But what happens? Moshe Rabbeinu adds, Hama'atu Rav, Amaher Orim, Habamachrim Bivtzorim, V'ashelos Haheima, and I'm looking at the last three lines here of the Hebrew text, V'ashelot Haheima, and these questions, Shehosiv Moshe Lishomir, that Moshe Rabbeinu added to the job description of the Meraglim, Ein Sofik Shehoyu L'Kavona Tova. He certainly had good intentions. Like Aaron had good intentions in making the Egel, he wanted to delay them simply until they would realize the truth. Moshe Rabbeinu also wanted to bring back a report in order to encourage them that the land was a beautiful land and that Sheyodu Yisrael ki ozo om v'orim gedolos v'tzuros, and they should know that the nations there are powerful and well entrenched, in order to appreciate the immensity of the Chasdei Hashem, that they would be victorious against the Canaanim and the Chittim, etc. So what's he saying here, the Ibn Ezra? The Abarbanel. I've gone through it a bit quickly because we've only got a few minutes left of the Shia, but I want to give you a taste of Abarbanel at his best. Originality from the Abarbanel, coming along and saying, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron, it's true that in the 40th year they were told to speak to the rock and they hit it instead. But this wasn't the real cause of their punishment, that they won't see the land of Israel. It's because all the reasons for which the whole generation couldn't go into the land of Israel, which was a combination of the golden calf and the spies, they were contributing factors to those averus. And therefore, it's not acceptable that they contributed to the sin and that they should then avoid the consequences of the sin. That was the Mishpat Hashem. I've given you here just really a little bit of an edited version of what is pages and pages and pages of his interpretation. I mean, he's very long-winded, and you need to take a long breath before you start his paragraphs, right? Because they get on and on. He says wonderful things. It's very interesting what he says. But he develops it always in a very elaborate style. That seems to have been the style of the period, that you write in such flowery and detailed way. Incidentally, also we looked last year, I think in this year, at some of the writings of the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague is actually living in Ashkenaz, and he's a contemporary of the Abarbanel. And the same period that the Abarbanel is living in Spain and experiencing the whole Girus Fard, the Maharal of Prague is living in Prague, and in Prague there is no expulsion, there is no inquisition, right? The Maharal of Prague is sitting and he is has a tremendous status, and he also writes this very lengthy, elaborate, stylistic writings. Maharal has written dozens and dozens of books, but again, you need a long breath before you go into a chapter, and you've got to know, got to trawl through it to find out what are his key ideas. So I think that the Abarbanel similarly has got this this style, seems to be a style of the 16th century. There are lots of other interesting aspects of the Abarbanel. He does deal, for example, with the issue of Gilgul Neshamot. Gilgul Neshamot is a very interesting subject. Maybe I'll deal with it a little bit more next week. But because what we're looking at in this period of history is the beginnings of, if you like, more mystical Kabbalistic thinking. Now, it really only took off in Tzfat, and the Abarbanel never made it to Tzfat. So Abarbanel wasn't part of the Kabbalistic revival of the Arizal and Rabbi Yosef Karo, and we looked at Shlomo Alkabetz in this year. A few of the individuals who really triggered off a total revival of mystical Kabbalistic thinking, which later on was the foundation of Hasidus. But the Ababil never made it there. He stayed in Christian Europe. He never made it into the Ottoman Empire at all, the way. But he's a contemporary of Rabbi Yosef Karo, who does make it to Tzfat, right? And there are Rizal who do make it to Tzfat. And all this is going on at the same time. So if you think that Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Arizal are in Tzfat doing their revival, the Abarbanel is in Spain and afterwards in Italy, writing his commentary and giving encouragement to the refugees from the Girisad. And at the same time, the Maral of Prague is sitting in Prague in Ashkenaz, and he's doing something else completely, right? None of them, of course, have ever seen the Shulchan Aruch, because the Shulchan Aruch hasn't been written yet, right? There is no Shulchan Aruch yet. The Halacha is all based on the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam. But what we have here is that he's got some interesting things to say about this idea of Gilgul Neshamot, the idea of what we call reincarnation, the idea that a neshama can leave this world and come back again in a different body. What is called, I'll introduce you to a very academic, fancy word, metempsychosis. You can look up metempsychosis is the word that academics use for Gilgul Neshamot, right? Which is the theory of people who have had previous lives. Right, there's a lot of literature about that. People who claim to have had previous lives. Is it indeed true that our neshama has been here before and will be here again? Is that true or not? This is not an easy question to answer. Certainly the Kabbalists believed in it very firmly, whereas Rashi and the Rambam and Tosfos never heard of it. They never mention it, they never heard of it, and it doesn't appear in any of the writings of the earlier Rishonim. Right? The only person who mentions this is Rav Sadia Gaon in the 9th century, and he rubbishes it. He says, I've heard this idea of the neshama coming back again, and this is not a Jewish idea, he says. This comes from the Far East, right? It's not a Jewish idea, and it's not part of the Torah. We don't find any sources for it anywhere in the Torah. But in the later Kabbalistic revolution of the Arizal, this then became one of the beliefs of the Kabbalistic world. The Abarbanel is maybe unique in the fact that he writes what is basically a rationalistic commentary on the Torah, but he incorporates Gilgul Neshama. So he says that is something which is very important to understand, and for various reasons, and maybe more about that, please God, next week. That's it for today. Ladies and gentlemen, nice to see you all here. And please God, next week we will go further. All the best.